Welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast. My guest today is Professor Adam Beaumont. Adam is a businessman, angel investor, trustee, and digital entrepreneur. He is the CEO and founder of telecommunications provider AQL and a visiting professor of cybersecurity at the University of Leeds. Hi, Adam. Great to have you with us and welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast.
Hi, Robin. Oh, thanks for that. It's great to be here.
So can you tell us what you do?
I'm a technologist, engineer, investor, curious person. I think probably the shortest sentence is that I like to solve complicated problems. So I started off as a scientist, as a chemist, and I had quite a long academic career. So I did my degree in chemistry, PhD in physical chemistry, and then I lectured in chemistry for 3 years. And this was in the 90s. It was during the late 90s that these little curious sockets started to appear on the walls in the laboratories. And these were sockets that connected things to the internet. So I started to become, I guess, less fascinated and enchanted with chemistry and more interested in this new invisible world, the internet, where somehow you could connect a machine and you could imagine it connecting to all these other machines out there. And I suddenly realized that I wasn't in the best place for me to pursue that career and to understand the internet. So I saw a job in the back of the Sunday paper, as jobs used to be advertised. And it was for an agency of the Ministry of Defense, and they wanted to build a secure communications and cyber team. So I thought I'd apply. And of course they asked me, what qualifications have you got for this job? I think my answer was curiosity. So I ended up running and building the first proper cyber capability within the mod. I stayed there for a couple of years, but working behind the fence was really not for me. And this was at the start of the dot-com boom. So I found myself learning to code and writing very rudimentary websites. If you look at archive.org, you'll see how bad this website was back in the 90s. But it was completely automated. It's what you would call these days a platform business. So it allowed customers to go to the website, search for a domain name, register the domain name, and pay with very little intervention from me. So in the late 90s, when there was the boom bust going on, I was running a very lean dot-com startup, which registered domains, and then later on hosted domains, hosted email. And that was the pivot point, really. So when you register a domain, you've really got no responsibility past that point. But as soon as you start to provide hosting services, email hosting services, you suddenly become on the hook 24/7 as a service delivery company, because that stuff's got to work. It's somebody else's lifeblood. That was the start of my technology journey. And I realized that what I was doing back then in the late 90s was, it was the gold rush. Everybody wanted to have their websites. So I was selling the shovels. And I thought, this is a great business model because we can hide in the background and power other companies and get them to market quicker by doing the bits that they don't want to do. So a couple of years later, we saw the start of what was the IP telephony revolution, or the voice over IP, VoIP revolution. And the bit that nobody wanted to do was host the telephone numbers. So we had these long and complicated conversations with Ofcom about how you get phone numbers. And eventually we registered 650 different area codes in the UK, about 6.5 million numbers. And we made those available via developer interfaces so that third-party resellers could sell phone numbers, the VR phone numbers hosted in the cloud, and they'd deliver these end-user services. And we built that in a really scalable way. The state of play now is we host around 105 million phone numbers, and we supply most of the UK phone numbers to any of the scale-ups that have a UK market. And this kind of went on. We then saw the IoT revolution. So we built an IoT platform. And again, we connect hundreds of thousands of end devices, both on land and on water. And it's all about enabling services. So come about 2008, as a northern-based business, we had this challenge that by history, all of our infrastructure was based in London, but all our engineering was based in the north. So we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could put more of our equipment in the north of England? And the challenge there is that pretty much all the connectivity into and out of the UK by history enters in and out of Docklands, London. Very little of that connectivity happens in the north. What we set out to do and managed to achieve was build the first standalone independent internet exchange outside of London within Leeds. Just to make that a little bit more difficult, in order to build this internet exchange, we had to work out where all the fiber operators overlapped as they come into Leeds and they all converge so that we can connect all the different fiber operators together to create this connection density hub to the rest of the world. The only building that was available to create this hub was a Grade 2 listed 1791 chapel. That might not seem like the most ideal high-tech building, but as I say, I like to solve complicated problems. The most important attribute of this building was its location. So we bought this building in the height of the recession. The bank pulled out of the mortgage at the last possible minute. Everything went wrong, but we managed to complete on the building and started to build out some infrastructure there. And it was literally by luck. I ended up 2 months later at an international engineering, internet engineering conference, and there was 5 minutes spare at the end of the day. And they said, who wants to do a quick lightning talk? And I put my hand up, ended up on stage and said, we've put Leeds on the internet map. And the global community, of course, they asked, where's Leeds? We kind of explained it was in the middle of the UK. And it turns out that was a very useful internet presence for a lot of the global carriers. And so suddenly we connected Leeds to the rest of the world. And Leeds is now a major node on a lot of global carrier maps. So we've built this enabling infrastructure over the past couple of decades. And now we've got this heavy lifting infrastructure. We use that to enable others, but also we use that to innovate ourselves and to build new services using that engine.
I mean, where do you start to unpack that? So you're clearly self-taught because, you know, you're a chemist and you ended up in the MOD, so went into the public sector, but clearly you're very much an entrepreneur but then you're clearly, like all good digital leaders, you're all about collaboration and sharing and positive behaviors like that to bring, it must be like herding cats, getting all those people to commit to one venue in Leeds. Are there some genes in the pool, kind of academia, that make you think, oh, you know, my grandfather, my grandmother was clearly the entrepreneur that I've sort of got this spirit from to get things done and create these amazing businesses?
Well, I did have an aunt who I remember when I was growing up, we hosted sort of cheese and wine parties at our house for our aunt to show off her business, which at the time was selling hanging baskets of all things. And it went from hanging baskets to selling the gift wrapping for presentation boxes, for toiletries that you see in Boots and whatever, then to hand sanitizer. And of course, we all thought, who'd ever want hand sanitizer? She was the entrepreneur in the family. But I never really thought of it as entrepreneurism. I just thought, this is interesting and it's a form of independence. I remember, I think I was about 11, I put an advert in the local newsagent window on those little cards where I used to pay 20p a week. And it said, punctures repaired, £1.50. It had our landline number. And to my mum's amusement, the phone started ringing. And it was started ringing several times a day. And I was going around picking up bikes, repairing punctures, returning them to their owners, and making some quite good money out of it for an 11-year-old. And this went on sort of throughout some of my teenage years. And I guess partnership is a key part of it, because I then started to work with the bicycle repair shops and said, have you got too much work for you to do? You could subcontract some of it to me. So I became very good at truing wheels, repairing bottom brackets, repairing headstocks, ball bearings, all that stuff. So I guess I've always worked on the premise of, if you can kind of do the bits that maybe people don't want to do, or the bit that gets in the way of them getting to market, which is what AQL does, then you can enable a whole channel of smart end delivery organizations. I mean, I love it when I get a text from a global scale-up And I just think, haha, that's one of our numbers. Or I know that I have a passcode from a global bank and I know that it's gone over our network. And we just know that we play this small part in it, but we do that across every single vertical, whether it's education, healthcare, logistics, and our technology is agnostic of all of that.
Let's talk a little bit about the leads thing then, because I think I first became aware of you myself when your chapel that you just were talking about was chosen by the then Prime Minister and George Osborne to launch the Northern Harper, the Northern Powerhouse strategy, you know, sort of standing in your chapel. And how does something like that happen, given it's a data center and a grade two listed chapel? Sort of, you share that journey.
When I bought the building, it was the end of a really hard week, and I had to go over to Bradford to get the keys off the agent. And it was about 6 or 7 o'clock at night. And I had the keys and I sort of let myself into the chapel. It was dark. The doors creaked. Everything you can imagine. The ceiling's falling in. It's largely derelict. And I remember sort of walking down the corridor with this kind of sense of exhilaration and also total fear, questioning what I'd done. Seeing the state of the place. For some reason, I thought, I've just bought a new building. I must go and read the electricity meters. So I found myself going down into the basement of this very spooky chapel, looking for electricity meters by myself with nobody knowing that I was there. And then just kind of having this moment where I thought, if this was a horror movie, everyone would be saying nobody would do that kind of thing. The whole building was a state. And we basically just picked one side of it, one room, and we restored that room, and then we restored the next room, and then we restored some toilets. And then by the time we got to this 7,500 square foot, the Congregational Chapel itself, which used to seat about 1,000, so it was the largest nonconformist chapel in Leeds, possibly in Yorkshire. By the time we got to that, we got an idea of what we could do with it and the vision of what it could look like. And we restored the upper gallery, which seats about 400. And below that, we built a data center, a couple hundred rack data center, and put in place, using a great Yorkshire fabrication company, put in place this whole stainless steel supporting structure with this laminated glass ceiling on it. So you could actually sit in the conference auditorium, or it's conference auditorium now, obviously it was a place of worship, and look down into this digital congregation. And so once we built this auditorium, I wanted to use that again as an enabling platform for other innovators, other people with an initiative that's for the good of the city, to be able to have somewhere where they could convene people. And the rules that we used were, if it was for the good of the internet, if it was for the good of young people, or for the good of the city, we'd host it for free. We've used that auditorium as a springboard for a lot of great organizations that started out on stage at Salem Chapel. And we'd hosted a couple of diplomatic missions. And so word got out that there was this unusual place in Leeds. And we ended up hosting the launch of the Northern Powerhouse for David Cameron and George Osborne to a completely full house. And it was absolutely electric, because I was just thinking that auditorium, that chapel, has never been as full of that as that for what must be about 40 to 50 years. The congregation started to dwindle in the late 50s, early 60s. When I acquired it, the congregational chapel part itself was a soup kitchen, needle exchange, DOS house. So you can imagine the state that this was in. To restore that and to restore it with private money, my money, and to turn it into something that's not only a working space, but actually a space which is now the main digital hub for the north of England. I sometimes just have to pinch myself. It's a place I kind of wander in late at night and look at the flashing lights and think of the terabits of data that are flowing through there. And it's probably one of the things I'm most proud of.
And quite rightly so. That's kind of when our paths first crossed, when that happened. And then since then, we'll come on to digital leadership a little bit later. But since then, you've been a a real supporter of digital leaders in Yorkshire in particular. You're also, you know, so philanthropy or social impact is definitely part of your makeup. I'm aware of these Beaumont Awards that you run with Leeds University, sort of inspired by Faraday. And then I know you're also closely involved in North Invest and investment into the north of the UK. So I guess the powerhouse and that whole agenda of moving funds to the north of the country, which, you know, that idea, I guess, began with the Leeds data center. Is that, you know, what do you think the state of play is with the north economically and its future?
I guess going back to that launch with George Osborne and David Cameron in 2015, I was lucky enough to have a private chat with them after the event. And George Osborne asked me, as an entrepreneur, what I felt my biggest challenges were and the biggest challenges within the region. And I just said straight away, it was access to funding and access to mentorship. When I started my businesses, I didn't know where to go. I did try to go to the bank, and if you're a technology company or a dot-com company, going to the bank is just a big no-no. And the idea of venture capital or angel funds was just something that was a closed door to me. My reply to George was that I want to rebuild the angel community in the Leeds City region. He suggested straight away, why don't you widen that aspiration to the north? And so North Invest was formed. I founded North Invest 2015. And I used the same democratic model as we used when we founded the Internet Exchange. And it's a Yorkshire model, which is a not-for-profit mutual owned by its members. Because it's a mutual, because it's there with a clear agenda and clear articles, which are to drive grassroots growth in the north, it's been really easy to bring brilliant people on that journey. That breathing life into something, if you can show clarity of purpose, getting great people has been no problem. And I've been lucky to have what is an absolutely exemplary board spanning education sector, private sector, public sector, enterprise, and other entrepreneurs. And we're investing across multiple pillars. I'm really pleased to say first quarter this year, we put 2 million into northern startups. And not just 2 million of investment, but 2 million of investment as smart money by passionate entrepreneurs who also want to mentor those businesses. And so for me, this is part of the solution as to how we build the world that we want in the place that we want to live. I don't want to live in London. I'm not a Yorkshireman, but I would like to say I'm a passionate Yorkshireman. I've been here for over 20 years and it feels like home to me. So being stubborn, I've wanted to try and create the environment in and around where I live to support my business, allow me to bring the skills in that I want and have the impact that I want, but also to take other smart entrepreneurs, smart innovators, and take them on that journey as well. The Beaumont Awards were never meant to be called the Beaumont Awards. When I went to university at Leeds, I won an award called the Jordan Award for my final year project. And Leeds is all about research-led education. So there's a very short, there's a low latency or short cycle between research learnings and that being ploughed back into teaching. So you're learning what is actually relevant to today rather than a sort of an aged curriculum. So I got this award from a family of projects. I kind of got it. I remember it felt good at the time. I put it away in a drawer. And a few years ago, I was kind of cleaning my office out, and I found this award. And I dropped a note to the vice chancellor at the university to say, does this award still exist? And sadly, it didn't. So I offered to sponsor, again, a similar award for final year projects which have the scope or capability to benefit society. With some of the work I've done with North Invest, I kind of tweaked that a little bit. And it's not just about benefiting society, but it's about finding really smart young students who are at the start of their career but can articulate how they want to impact the world in a positive way. And I wanted to provide a bit of a platform to them and a bit of encouragement. So originally, the idea was to create the Faraday Award, and I'll talk a bit more about Faraday later as a sort of inspirational luminary in science. But there's actually a Royal Society Award called the Faraday Award, so that would have been a little bit tricky to do. So the safe option was to use a name that I know that I have some rights over, which is Beaumont Award. I formed that 3 years ago. We've had 34 award winners, I believe, so far. And it's been really hard to judge these awards. And the diversity of projects and people has just been amazing. So we've got this kind of alumni of alumni, a cohort of people who want to create positive impact. And I'm just trying to keep them close and inspired because I want to kind of support them through the rest of their career and help them have the impact that they want to have.
So we were very excited to host those awards virtually in the DigiLounge, hashtag DigiLounge this year. And they were an amazing bunch, as you say, really diverse. Diverse projects and diverse profiles. I mean, no sort of formulaic winners. And you could see that they understood that link between industry and investment and what they were doing and the value of the award and the connection and the mentoring that sort of comes with it. So congratulations on that. That was really positive. So what are you currently focused on? I mean, you're clearly someone who sees what's coming down the road and gets in ahead of it. So what, without giving, you probably won't tell me what the very latest thing is, but you know, what's coming down the track that you're focused on at the moment?
One of my hats is I'm a trustee of the Eden Project. And Eden is actually a series of global projects. People think of the Cornwall site, but one of the huge impacts of the COVID pandemic has been the ability to open a public visitor attraction. So Eden's been hit really hard by this. We've had to do quite a big restructure. So I've been heavily involved with how we can use technology to manage public safety on that site, but also how we can pivot Eden more into the digital domain, into the virtual domain, and how we can link some of our sites virtually as one common narrative. So that's been something that I've been spending a lot of time working on. Other than that, building a few startups that are relevant to solving some of the new problem statements that the pandemic has created. One of those is a sanitization as a service company called Handy. If you look at the Gulf Open or the British Airways advert, you'll see our product on there. Again, that's been sort of an exercise in entrepreneurship and an acceleration 4 months from formation to having product in the marketplace and a healthy sales pipeline. So again, I think it was the cabin fever of the lockdown that's just made a few of us entrepreneurs galvanize ourselves to do something to keep us out of trouble and to do something that's going to have positive impact.
So it sounds like you should be on Dragon's Den, Adam, in the sense of that network of projects, because you know, to end up with a hand sanitizer business and also the connections to get into those large markets quickly is the sort of thing that the Dragons, you know, are offering to the great ideas that come through the door. So is that North Invest or are there, just maybe say a little bit about that network and how, sure, and how that works.
Things that have worked really well. And I'll just go back to your DigiLounge platform. Hosting the awards, the Beaumont Awards the other day on that platform felt really natural. And I think that we're all starting to get more used to this platform approach of working. We were virtually wandering around the different virtual tables at the awards, chatting to the proud parents of the winners, and it felt natural. One of the pivots of North Invest has been to move from real physical pitch events to virtual pitch events. If anything, that's transformed what we do, because instead of having to work around travel times and diaries, we're holding a few pitch events a month. We're holding them across the entire of the North. They're really well attended. And so that that's just really transformed our effectiveness. So if anything, we've become more active during the pandemic than less. And I think that, again, those businesses that can pivot, they're going to be in a much better position. And for those that can't, again, we've got teams of mentors and investors that can help them with the 2.0 version of their business.
Let's talk a little bit about digital leadership. So you've described your journey from the 1990s. Obviously, you've kind of been on that journey with the rest of public-private sector of digital transformation. But in terms of leadership, where do you think we are at the moment? Are you now meeting leaders of organizations who have a great set of digital leadership behaviors, or do you think there's still a ton of work to be done?
I think there's multiple parts to that question. I think that there's still a challenge in terms of understanding what digital means. And a lot of people will default to, we need a better website, or my email's not working, or can I maybe do this on an app on my phone. Digital thinking is looking at how you can replace traditional business processes. One of my kind of founding tenets of my business was, if it's boring, we automate it. And that was how we started, and that's how we've stayed lean. That means that we can give our people the interesting things to do. Machines are for repetitive tasks. And it's looking at those business processes end to end and seeing which business processes should exist, need to exist. And that's across every vertical, whether it's marketing, billing, delivery, whatever. I don't think that there's enough digital representation and diverse digital representation at board level. We don't stripe digital across the traditional sort of silos of finance, of marketing, of commerce. And that's something that I think it's going to take another decade or so before. And sadly, a lot of traditional business models fall by the wayside before we really start to grasp onto this.
I couldn't agree more with that. I guess there are the traditional tech and digital sectors, but there are a whole load of new sectors that are adopting this technology who have seen a rapid acceleration during COVID-19 and now have to face perhaps a new reality beyond it. Let's move on to our quickfire round, Adam, and find out a bit more about you, kind of revealed by your choices. So our first item is the book. So what one book would you recommend to our listener and why?
If I could possibly have two, I don't know if that's cheeky.
We've had it before. We're very polite on the Digital Leaders podcast. You can get away with two.
There was two books I read in 1984 that stood out to me. One was 1984, but that's not the one I'm going to talk about. The other was a book called Sun Traps by John Elkington. And this was one of the first data-driven, creating a case for renewable energy. And I remember reading this from cover to cover several times, just thinking, wow, this is the future. This is where we've got to head. And that was the gateway drug that led me to the Center for Alternative Technology, that led me to being a trustee at Eden. And that's come full circle now. And now Eden and I are working with John Elkington. So that's really exciting for me. But the more, I guess, recent intervention and staying on the technology theme is a book called Bold by Peter Diamandis. Peter was one of the founders of the Singularity University, and singularity is the concept of accelerating technology. So, for example, Moore's Law and processor density. And next year, we'll be able to do four times as much stuff with the computers as we can do now. It's the idea of a singularity concept is looking at different converging themes of accelerating technology. So, for example, that could be the accelerating innovation in electric motors, which, for example, there was the invention of the switch reluctance electric motor that not many people know much about. And then there's the accelerating change in materials technology. And you put those together, and then you have a 3D printer. as soon as you have additive manufacturing, you can then create a whole world of things that you couldn't create before, and you can rapid prototype. And so it's that singularity thinking of how do you put two things together synergistically to create something that's even more exponential than the sum of its parts. That book, Bold, and that singularity thinking, that really had an effect on me.
Brilliant. Okay, two good books there. Lunch. So you can have lunch with anyone you like, living or dead. So who's your guest going to be and why?
I would choose Michael Faraday, who we mentioned a little earlier. So I grew up with Magnus Pike, David Bellamy, Patrick Moore, Johnny Ball, and they were all of my generation, inspiring people, making science and technology accessible. I should also say Maggie Philbin, making science and technology accessible to the masses in a way that it could be understood. And that's exactly what Michael Faraday did. It was research-led education. He took complex scientific processes that were little understood at the time and turned them into a series of public lectures and Christmas lectures for the layperson in a way that was engaging. And reading some of his lectures today, they're still just as engaging, just as enjoyable. I know it sounds terribly geeky, but I would recommend his Chemistry and Science of a Candle book. It's really quite fascinating how you can break down something that we take for granted back into its fundamental science and technology.
Love that guest choice. And then our last question is always one thing our listener would be surprised to find out about you.
I was one of one of the very early investors in a company called Gravity. Gravity is quite a high-risk investment, but again, what really grabbed me about what they'd done is they'd used 3D printing as a form of rapid prototyping to be able to fail fast, fail many times, and invent and create what is the first human jet suit. So I was lucky enough to be an early stage investor, but also one of the first few to be able to fly the suit. I guess that's a thing that not many people have done.
Yes, no, I think you could definitely say flying a jet suit is definitely a fairly limited list. It's fairly high profile, isn't it? Because I guess any man flying around in a jet suit, who is the kind of main person there?
So Richard Browning is the founder and chief test pilot.
So it's him who's usually flying when it's not you.
Oh, for sure. No, I've only done it once. And it's a visceral and an amazing experience. And what I would say is that Richard makes it look very easy. He's very skilled.
And when you say high risk investment, I imagine it's quite high risk having presumably fuel strapped to yourself.
There's a lot of safety features. A lot of it's taken from the motorsport industry in terms of how you manage fuel safely. I guess for me, and this is a running theme throughout my investments, is I tend to invest in something that possibly could have intellectual property. They'll have a patent applied for, but the patent won't have gone to grant. So I kind of trust my own judgment by reading the patents as to whether I think that it could fly or not, pardon the pun. So I've been an early stage investment in multiple companies, whether it's artificial diamonds, whether it's med tech, whether it's jet drones, in that early stage before the patent goes to grant, because whilst it can be high risk, if and when these things do, generally there's quite a valuation shift.
Brilliant. So look, Adam, that's just been great fun talking to you on the Digital Leaders podcast. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Absolute pleasure. See you soon.
That is it for this episode of the Digital Leaders podcast. Now, of course, we would love to know your thoughts. Tag us at DigiLeaders and let us know. And if you want to find out more about today's guest, head on over to our website, digileaders.com/podcast, and we have all that information there. That is it for this week. I'm your host, Robin Knowles. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of
the Digital Leaders Podcast.